Choke points.
Let's go.
How do you turn a $2 tunnel toll into a $50 toll? It's surprisingly easy, as Chris explains.
Yeah, you just blow off your mail from the toll department and from Good to Go. Good to Go use in the Seattle Tunnel, we told you last week, is running around 83% now through the first three or so months of tolling. But that means 17% of users are paying by mail, waiting for the bill to arrive after their trips. Now, if you fail to pay that bill during the first week of tolling, say you went through there the first couple of weeks, you know, thereabouts, and you haven't paid that bill, you're going to see a really larger bill start showing up, one that's called a civil penalty. $40 civil penalties are now going out in the mail for drivers who have failed to pay their toll bills that have come to in the mail. Patricia Michaud is the customer service operations manager for Good to Go. These penalties can turn a $2 toll to close to $50.
Perhaps I just wasn't paying attention. I didn't realize that tolling was started. I'll set it up later. I get the bill. I'll take care of that later. And it escalates to a civil penalty. And oh my gosh, I've got my toll plus $40 plus the $5 reprocessing fee. So that's quite a bit. That's quite a hit.
Civil penalties go out after 80 days after you haven't paid that for the bill that comes in the mail. So that's why we're just now starting to see these civil penalties going out from those first couple of weeks of tunnel tolling in November. But Michaud says that those penalties can be wiped away, but all you have to do is call the customer service.
We give customers an opportunity to just pay the toll and we'll waive the fee and the penalty. And then we solve the problem. Okay, why did you get a toll bill in the first place? And what do we need to do to prevent this escalating up to a civil penalty?
Now, drivers get to use this waiver once, basically saying, oh, mea culpa, I just blew this off, whatever. But Ms. Shod says that the Good to Go will work with drivers. I mean, maybe a couple times. Repeat offenders, no way. They're going to be like, listen, stop, fool me once, shame on me. What is it, fool me twice? Whatever. So if they the most important thing to do is that, you know, there's some common issues that people have that get these civil penalties that they don't realize.
Is your address up to date? Is your plate on your account? Did you install your pass? Is your credit card up to date? So those are the things that they'll troubleshoot through.
Now, if you're saying, oh, what's the big deal? A civil penalty, $40, whatever, they're going to come after me? Well, yeah, eventually, if you don't pay this, you're not going to be able to get your tabs. There's going to be a hold on your car, and then eventually you're going to have to pay the whole thing. Michaud says the best thing to do is just call customer service and work it out.
What we want to make sure customers do is call us. If they're having problems with their account or if they're getting toll bills and it doesn't make sense, call us and we'll figure it out with you.
You know, I've actually gone through this waiver process. When we added a new car, newer car to our Good to Go account about a year and a half ago or something like that, maybe longer now, I got a bill in the mail after driving 405 and I was like, oh, this has got to be a mistake. I've registered the card, blah, blah, blah. But it turns out the timing was off by about a day. I had taken 405 about a day before I had actually registered the car. Mm-hmm. So I called up customer service and they're like, oh, yeah, here's the bill. Oh, we saw that you set it up a day later, whatever, you're good. They waived the penalty and the fee, and I just paid the toll that I actually owed. Historically, about 2% of all pay-by-mail bills end up in these civil penalties. Wow. So the bottom line is if you use the tunnel without a good-to-go pass in those first couple weeks of tolling, don't blow off that toll bill that comes in the mail. All it will cost you is, you know, a couple of minutes talking to customer service. And again, the reason we're doing this now is because we have a whole new group of people that have probably gotten their toll passes, you know, for going through the tunnel lately. This works, though, for any good-to-go account or any good-to-go mistake you think you might have. Simplest thing to do is just call customer service and see what you can do. And that amnesty does work out pretty nicely, man. I've used it, and, yeah, they're really nice about it, and you'll work through it.
But bottom line is they're serious about having you pay the toll.
Yeah. I mean, they just want to collect the toll. They don't want to collect the extra $40. They'd rather they didn't. But they just want you to pay the toll because that needs to be done. But, yeah, if you blow this off long enough, you won't get your tabs.
Yeah. That's actually the way it is with most bills. If you blow off the bill, it doesn't just go away.
Yeah, exactly.
I've noticed that.
Yeah. Apparently people really want their money.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is no...
Yes, they do.
So if you need a, you know, kind of a, you know, how to do it, a 411 kind of work, go to mynorthwest.com. I've got the links there, how to go through it and work through it. And it's really relatively simple.
You recall that about a month ago, we seemed to be teetering on the brink of war with Iran. Well, now the Pentagon is reporting a major jump in the number of cases of traumatic brain injury following Iran's retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Revolutionary Guard. Let's go to CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausin, who joins us live now. They're now reporting, Jeff, more than 100 soldiers have brain injuries from this missile strike. This is coming from the Pentagon. And so I asked this question on behalf of people who are always on the lookout for anyone in the deep state trying to make Donald Trump look bad. Is that what's going on here, or did we just not know originally how bad the casualties were?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I don't think we really knew. Some of the symptoms of TBI can manifest themselves over time. It's not immediate, as if a more conventional wound that you might receive if you were hit by shrapnel or something else. On the other hand, I think the present administration has handled this thing pretty poorly. I mean, the president's remarks said, well, it was minor and they had a few headaches, and kind of didn't dismissing all this, has really outraged a lot of veteran groups. Mm-hmm. I think for a president and administration who has traditionally tried to paint themselves as being very, very supportive of the military and the veterans, they might have handled that in a particular better way.
I still am having trouble figuring out why this took so long. I mean, it has been about a month. The troops we know got some sort of advance warning, so they were able to go into the bunkers. Now, are these injuries from people who didn't make it into the bunkers, or they were in the bunkers, but they weren't deep enough?
Right. I think it was the latter, Dave. I mean, we don't know exactly how they were exposed. Were they outside or were they inside? They did receive some warning. How much in advance of the particular attack is somewhat has been disputed. Did they have sufficient time to get undercover? And, of course, we're talking about blast overpressure. And that can get down and get you even if you're down in a bunker. The final problem with the TBI in particular, Dave, is that it's a cumulative problem. Think of football players. It's not that one hit on the head that causes them long-term injury. What it is repeated blows to the head. So you and I, for example, if we were exposed to a blast overpressure, we might react in different ways, frankly, because our baselines were different. I might have been an athlete and had several minor concussions before I joined the military. You might not have. Or we might have been in the military together, and I had been on a number of combat missions and been exposed to concussions and blast overpressure, where you're a new guy and you were not. So our baseline, and therefore how susceptible we are to injury, is quite different.
Now, was this standard for assessing injuries or counting what counts as a casualty, was that used back in the day during the battle in Iraq, for example, when people were being hit by IEDs all the time? Because I recall, of course, the reports of people who were killed or, you know, badly injured or lost a limb. I don't recall casualties including brain injuries or concussions.
Yeah, one of the only few good things about war is we learn an awful lot about medical things along the way, and we learn very quickly. And if there's been two injuries that we've learned a great deal about, it's been TBI and PTSD in the course of the war in Iraq. Early on, it was, hey, kind of shake it off. Yeah, you look okay, and we're going to put you right back in the unit. Over time, as I said, we began to understand the cumulative effect on people. There was even an effort at one point in time, because I spent a few days with the people who did research on TBI down at Fort Detrick, that the Army was thinking about putting dosimeters on people's helmets that would record cumulative overpressure effects, so we could figure out how much, you'd been injured versus me in any particular instance. That was not done, and there has been a widespread difference of opinion, but finally the awarding of the Purple Heart to those who have been injured by TBI. Many of these guys, I think, will probably get Purple Hearts. Finally, Dave, I think one of the other interesting things the researchers have told me is they firmly believe there's a correlation, though I don't think it's been yet scientifically proven, between those who suffer TBI and their propensity to demonstrate a post-traumatic stress disorder later in their lives.
Right. So as of now, and we're again talking about this one incident in retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani, 109 troops were diagnosed with brain injuries. 76 have returned to duty, but apparently that would imply that 33 are still being hospitalized.
That's correct. And some of those guys might have been in a position where they were exposed to greater overpressure, number one, or as I mentioned, number two, they might be more vulnerable based on previous injuries. And these can be quite severe, to the point of them not being redeployed. A number of these guys who were injured, by the way, have been evacuated from Iraq. I imagine they went through the Landstuhl Army Hospital in Germany, where our casualties go from Iraq, and have been evacuated to the United States, and probably down at our Walter Reed Bethesda Naval Hospital facilities down in the Washington area.
CBS military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, Dave. Thank you.
Legislators have been busy in Olympia, setting up rules that will possibly affect your commute, and if you work for a big company, maybe even how much you earn. And that's why Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here to tell us what is brewing.
So, automated vehicles, they're coming, and we need to set up and get some rules ready for them. That was the discussion in Olympia yesterday. The House Transportation Committee heard a bill that was basically proposed. It was requested from the Uniform Law Commission as part of a national work that's being done to try to standardize rules around the country regarding automated vehicles. Now, this bill lays out registration requirements and rules for how they need to be operated. It also exempts some of the driver's license requirements of a person taking a completely automated trip, so you wouldn't necessarily have to have a driver's license to be on that automated trip. And it also removes the regulations for cell phone use, and if we're on a fully automated trip or and other kind of technical.
Do they define what fully automated means?
Fully automated means, yes, that it doesn't switch back and forth from.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It never tells you to grab the wheel.
It never tells you to grab the wheel. So that is the bill. And the fact that it exempts, though, still the EDUI requirements was a concern for law enforcement. James McMahon is with the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs.
Figuring out if we see the driver texting, the person in the driving seat texting, but they can go in and out of automated mode, at what point does it become unenforceable?
So EDUI means driving under the influence of a smartphone, essentially.
Yes,
electronic
DUI. It does, yeah. Okay. And it talks about like TVs that are in your view,
yeah,
any kind of screen that's in the driver's view. But the law enforcement also had other concerns, several.
If one of our officers encounters an automated vehicle and pulls it over, to whom shall we issue the infraction?
Yes.
If an automated vehicle is in a collision, is the vehicle itself at fault? Appears to show that a person need not have a driver's license or understand or be qualified for the rules of the road. In fact, my 12-year-old could operate a fully automated vehicle under the provisions of this, and I would hope that's not what you all intend. She does okay, but not that well.
Yeah, this is going to determine whether we get this or not. If the corporation that designs the software is liable for any accidents, who's going to invest in that company? I think the exposure would be huge.
Huge. And again, so my sense in listening to this hearing, again, this was a request from that Uniform Law Commission, and there's trying to get these standardized rules around the country. I don't know that question is completely answered yet. I think there's more debate to be done. And that was kind of the gist in this hearing yesterday, because, look, we have a state autonomous vehicle work group that's been around for a while that didn't get a chance to hear this because the request for the bill came in after their last meeting. So, and the State Transportation Commission didn't get a chance to look at this yet either, really debated it all. So they're going to take it up in May. So it doesn't sound like necessarily this bill is going to make it out this session. The general sense was that more work was needed.
These new terms and concepts have never been used in any jurisdiction and will likely cause more confusion.
The bill is premature and reinforces a misguided approach to autonomous vehicle safety. The approach to safety codified in this bill is nonsense. In every other system of public conveyance, whether it's a boat, an elevator, rail car, or airplane, we require an independent third party to validate the safety of the vehicle design and the training of the operator. We should accept no less when it comes to autonomous vehicles.
And this particular bill kind of, it's like a self-reporting under penalty of perjury that you're kind of saying that the vehicle, whoever the operator or owner is of the vehicle, is dealing with the safety aspect. And that was the concern from that gentleman right there.
Okay.
Work needed.
What about car tabs for non-self-driving cars?
So we talked about there were three car tabs working their way through the legislature, bills, I should say, for car tab relief. We had a couple on the Republican side. It's cut off. We're at a key deadline today, as a matter of fact, for transportation legislation to move. And it looks like those two did not get a vote. But the other one from the Democratic side, Senator Marco Elias's bill, which essentially repeals I-976, but does give you that little maybe $40-$50 of car tab relief off your bill, That one did get a vote out of committee, so that one seems to be the one that's alive at the moment.
That's the one that moves us to the 2005 valuation schedule, but not Kelly Blue Book, which we voted on.
Mm-hmm. So that would reduce tabs somewhat.
Somewhat. It's the middle of the road one. Basically, it's the compromise that gets you, you know, 40, 50 bucks off your car tab bill, but also ensures that the light rail continues to move forward as planned.
I see. Okay, but that if you overturn an issue, you need a two-thirds vote.
Do
they have a two-thirds vote?
I don't know if they can answer that question.
What is the party breakdown in the legislature now? I don't know.
Oh, you know, Democrats, big majorities, both chambers.
But they don't have two-thirds, do they?
No, they don't have two-thirds. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I don't know that all Republicans vote against this bill. It's close.
And from what I'm hearing, not all Democrats would vote for it either.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, especially in Pierce County, are like, hey, we voted for X. We want Kelly Blue Book. And they're not sure if, going along with the 2005's valuation schedule is what their constituents want. So we're not sure where that one will go on either side.
Yeah,
so if this doesn't pass then and the initiative basically kicks in, what's the plan B? because the money gets cut off, right?
Right. Well, and so that's a separate thing, that's a transportation budget conversations, and there's plenty of those discussions going on right now. I mean, essentially, the Senate Transportation Committee is working on taking out whatever the nearly half billion dollars needed out of the transportation budget.
Yeah.
So that's going on. But as far as any car tab relief, that's the only bill on the table at the moment. And this is very similar to ones that we've had in previous sessions that never make it out of the gate at the end. So this is alive for the moment. Also, really quickly, on the ban on gas cars, we had a hearing on that yesterday.
How'd that go?
We heard, as expected, I would say. On the pro side, we had folks like this.
It's been tremendous innovation in that area. So the Tesla Model 3, for example, you can charge 180 miles in 15 minutes with a 250-kilowatt charger. That's almost double what it was just a couple of years ago. So the charging is moving forward very, very quickly.
Electrified transportation can reduce our overall emissions dramatically. It's the kind of systemic change we need to avert the worst consequences of climate change.
So those were responses to various questions that came up about whether we could build out this capacity for charging. There were also a lot of questions from lawmakers and plenty of opposition, especially from the propane industry, right? They get a lot of incentives. Mm-hmm. And I think various cities are using them for buses and things like that. And they were concerned that they didn't have a place in this legislation as one of the options. Also, the car dealers, auto dealers, which I think one of you asked me about yesterday when we talked about this, they were concerned. They want, electric vehicles are there's more interest in them now, but it's not all the interest, and they want to be able to give their customers what they want and have the market drive the market.
I love how everyone brings up Tesla. Well, that's great. I'm sure glad everybody can afford a $40,000 car at base model.
Well, and that was how long, what are they worth, are they holding their value, right? That kind of thing. Somebody made one of the pro people said, look, back 10 years ago, did everybody think everybody was going to have an iPhone in their hand? Now, no. Yeah. So this is kind of the same thing. But others said, I don't even have an iPhone, and not everybody in rural areas does. So.
I'd still be, we haven't got time in this segment, but if everybody has the electric car, that's more pressure on the power grid. And if you're really going to reduce your carbon footprint, that industrial power have to come from where? Nuclear power?
And that's the question.
Nuclear power.
Because there's other discussions going on right now about the Bonneville power area.
But in that bill, what does it say? We have an abundant source of hydroelectric power.
Yeah.
And basically they said it's an unlimited and as it's written in the law. That's the assumption they're going with.
Yeah, and there's a lot of concerns and questions about that because there are other issues in the state going on that make that seem that that's not likely.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. An Austin, Texas filmmaker bought a VHS player from his local Goodwill store for a project, and when he plugged it in, he stumbled upon a treasure.
Tyree learns to walk, September 27th, 1994.
There was a VHS tape inside the player, a family's home movie of their baby son's first steps.
A dining room in the back, it was Tyree in diapers, his dad on the floor holding him and kind of propping him up at first, and his little brother on the side watching and cheering.
So Jim McKay and KVUE-TV teamed up to try and find that family. McKay shot his own video, hoping it would go viral in order to find the family on that precious film.
I'm sharing this video with you in hopes that you can help. I want to find this family. I want to give them this tape back, along with these amazing memories, and also their VCR so they can watch it.
And despite it being from 1994, it didn't take long after KVUE's story aired. Reporter Louis DeLeon takes it from here.
My mom called and she's like, hey, you know you're on TV right now?
Meet Tyree Alexander. He was just 10 months old in the video.
I was like, oh, snap. And that's when I realized that's my dad.
Moments later, on the phone with Jim, which would soon lead to him getting back a video not only vintage, but practically foreign to him.
I have never seen it before. To be able to share that memory and that moment finally with my family and for the first time, it's a treasure.
There it was. The 10-month-old in that video, that's who you're hearing talk. And what's incredible, I'm going to put this story up on my Twitter page because you have to see it. In the whole movie from 1994, there's, you know, the dad holding the 10-month-old. Mm-hmm. And then cut to the picture of that 10-month-old as a grown man. Looks exactly like the dad.
Of course.
The body, the build, the everything. It just gave me chills to watch. So what a precious thing to do.
We have all my dad's video. He started taking videos in 1980. Maybe 82. And we have them all because my nephew, who works in software, put them all on a huge disk drive. And I try to watch a little bit of it each week. Dad would just turn on the camera. And that was back when you had to have a backpack, right?
Oh, I remember those. Yes, yeah. My mother always carried hers around on her shoulder. And you could hear the zoom of the camera, too.
Yeah,
they were
right.
So clunky.
He just let it run
yeah.
for hours.
Oh, yes.
Just vacations, you know. It's almost like being there. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. I want to talk about the Dragons in a moment. Cheapest ticket price, by the way, now $41. But you're a car guy, right?
Yes, sir.
We were talking about self-driving cars, and the legislature is trying to decide how the insurance is going to work on this. So if you were, if you bought a self-driving car, and I'm talking about the full
no steering
artificial
wheel.
Intelligence deal, right? No
right.
steering wheel, maybe a red button in case of an emergency. And you get into an accident. Mm-hmm. Who's liable for that?
Depends on your insurance.
What does that
so
mean?
So you have an opportunity at that moment to decide, like, hey, Dave Ross, you got this autonomous car. Congratulations to you. Now it's time for you to get insurance. When you get that insurance, here's your choices. You can get this insurance premium, and if you were to get into an accident, it would be your fault because you're with that vehicle.
Uh-huh.
But if you pay for this insurance at a little higher premium, then it would be the company's fault, and then we'll kind of insure it from there. So I think it'll be you'll have a choice.
So the poor people would be held liable; the rich people would not.
You know what, Dave? You can sit here and pull that till you're blue in the face. The bottom line is this: that, you know, we can say that sometimes you have situations where some folks can. You know, get this, and some folks can get that. The poor people can't go on vacation twice a year, and the rich people can.
Well, that's true.
It's unfortunate, but yes, that's the only way you can do it. Now, Dave,
All right.
Who should?
Well, I think if you're not actively in control of the car, I don't see how you can be held liable. You've bought this car trusting that the company's done its job. And so if its software is lacking, and it's been certified as ready for the road, right? It's road legal, street legal. And it hits a pedestrian, and I didn't do a thing. I just sat there, you know, playing with my iPhone like I'm allowed to do. I think it's the company's fault.
Have you ever had a computer glitch at work, Dave?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well.
I'm not quite sure there'll be a computer.
Yes, I know. That's what I mean.
There'll be a computer glitch on the road.
That's what I mean. All right, so the Dragons are playing, and apparently this has turned out to be really popular. I was just checking the ticket site to see if they're going to open up the 300 section. I don't think they've opened up the 300 section yet. But if they
really?
Did, then prices might drop back to $24.
Colleen needs to go to this.
I would love to. You got some sweet tickets?
Sweet meaning
sweet as in
SUITE
or SU.
Yeah.
Oh, because I can get the SW.
I like to go to games in style, G.
Mm.
No, I'd love to check it out. I wasn't able to watch this weekend, but I heard a lot of excitement from Sully and from Dave and from, I mean, people are, this is good stuff.
I think it'll be good. But one thing about Seattle is this. Seattle is a place where there is a lot of things to do because a lot of times people like to say, oh, there's fair weather fans in Seattle. It's not fair weather fans. It's like, look, there's a lot of things happening here. You can go hiking. You can do all types of activities here in Seattle. So if you're not winning, Seattle folks is not going to really go to those games. So yeah. What I would like to see is – they go this weekend, and they continue to go. Give this team a chance. Don't just go there and expect have all these expectations that they need to win right away. I mean, there's only 8 teams. They lost one game. They were kind of in it a little bit, ended up losing 31-19. I still think that they got the opportunity.
Well, what makes it so good?
Why should we go and watch? What makes it better than a hike?
Well, if you like football, one. But two, if you don't like football, this is an opportunity for you to go and find out who the new person is going to be, who's going to be that person that has the opportunity to move on to the NFL.
I see. So this is a farm system.
But by the way, I'm the wrong person to ask of why you should go see football over hiking.
You're the one trying to make the case, so I'm just asking the questions.
I'm just saying there's just so much to do here in Seattle.
I think the thing about the XFL is it's to me, I found it a more interesting form of football just because of what the other stuff that they do, the way they've speeded up the game. Some of the new rules I think are pretty exciting. And what I watch for are those, what, physically impossible athletic feats where you throw a 78-yard pass and a guy actually catches it. I'm still amazed by that. And I saw a lot of that in last week's game.
You also saw a lot of hitting.
Yeah.
Lots of good hitting.
That's what you liked?
So I enjoyed that. Lots of really good hitting.
Do you think the XFL can be a testing ground for the NFL to change some rules? Like, hey, let's try this and test it out on these guys.
I think they're definitely going to change the rules when it comes to the kickoff.
Because of the results from the XFL?
Yes. The XFL is much safer. And if the NFL is really behind making the game safer, then kick returns and special teams and things, that would be a great place to start. I think the XFL knocked it out of the park. Dave, I was going to ask you a question. You brought up the different hiking and football. How could you talk someone into going to an XFL game over the opera?
Over the opera?
Yeah.
That'd be pretty easy. There's always something going on and you have a chance of understanding it. With the opera, sometimes it's very difficult to understand unless you're familiar with what's going on unless you've educated yourself.
You can
go to an XFL game without having to pre-educate yourself, I think, and still enjoy it.
What would be the first thing that you would, if I went to the opera with you, what would you teach me so that I would know?
I would have to start a week ahead of time and give you the record so you could listen to it first. And then we talk about the plot and what's significant. And then we talk about the voices and what makes them great. There's a lot of prep that goes into the opera.
You just taught me something. Wait, there's a plot at the opera?
Yeah. Yeah.
These are just stories that they sing.
Yeah.
It's a play with singing.
Oh, have you
really,
been?
Really good.
Have
oh, yeah. Been? I love the opera.
Like musical.
I haven't been lately, but yeah.
What
fun.
Do you wear to the opera?
Suit.
You wear a suit?
No,
I still do, yeah. Mom and dad would roll over if I didn't wear a suit.
The other thing you have to understand is that it's acoustic. It's not amplified in any way. That's why they have to sing really loud. But we have time for that. If you want to go to an opera, we can.
I didn't say that.
By the way, no reindeer at the opera. No reindeer.
Except on your way to your car afterwards.
Thanks, Dave.
G. Scott starts up with Ursula at 9 right here on Cairo Radio. And on Tuesday mornings, what do? We go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. First of all, David, as the Trump watchdog, you have been looking into how much the Secret Service pays to stay at his hotels, and what have you come up with?
Well, what we've learned so far, and there's a lot we don't know, but what we've learned so far is that the Trump organization charged the Secret Service $650 per night per room for hotel rooms in Mar-a-Lago. And in Bedminster, they charged $17,000 a month for a cottage that the Secret Service used on the grounds of Trump's golf club. So in Bedminster, at least, Trump even got paid when he wasn't there.
Now, I assume that's the market rate, isn't it?
Well, no. In fact, in Bedminster, it's about double the market rate. In Mar-a-Lago, you know, it's a private club, so they don't publish their rates. It seems like it might be in line with, you know, Palm Beach high season rates. But what's important to know here is the Trump organization had previously said what they charge, and they said they charge nothing or almost nothing. Eric Trump had said, when government officials come with my father to our clubs, they stay for free or maybe just for the cost of housekeeping. So that was what they'd said publicly, not like we're going to charge them as much as we can. They said we're going to charge them almost nothing. In reality, they're charging them $650 a night.
Well, now how did you get that figure?
What we did was look at public records that had been released sort of slowly by the Secret Service, which were receipts from Mar-a-Lago to the Secret Service. And a lot of them are redacted, but we managed to talk to people who'd seen the unredacted versions. These are things that the government is supposed to publish. Any transaction over $10,000 is supposed to be published online so anybody can see it. And they weren't publishing these at all, so we had to track them down in receipts.
They're redacting the bills for Mar-a-Lago? How is that possible?
Well,
That's, so, I don't think that's a national security consideration, is it?
They do. They say that's important law enforcement information, so we can't tell you what rate they paid. But thankfully, they left open the number of days they paid for and the total, so you could just divide one by the other.
Okay. So, I mean, I assume that somebody at the Washington Post, maybe even you, put in a call to the White House to ask for verification of this?
We did. The White House wouldn't comment on this. Secret Service had a couple of sort of brief comments. The interesting comment was the Trump Organization. We went back to them and said, look, you said you charged just the cost of housekeeping, but we figured out now it's like double the going rate, or it's $650 a night. What are you paying your housekeepers that it costs $650 a night to clean a room? And they responded by sticking to their previous line. This is just our cost. We just charge our costs.
We just charge up, but they also said it was going to be free.
Yeah, Eric Trump said last year, if you remember, Trump had this idea to put the G7 summit at Doral.
Right.
And during that, when everyone was like, oh my God, he's going to send this giant government contract to himself, Eric Trump went out and said, look, you know, you don't have to worry about this. This is a great deal for the government. When they come to our properties, they stay for free, or maybe just the cost of housekeeping.
I'm trying to reconcile this. Somebody appears to be not telling the truth. It can't be the president. So it must be that somebody made an error in those documents that you managed to get. Or maybe what they're doing is sort of gaslighting you. They're planting these phony documents so you think you have a really good scoop, but in fact you have nothing.
If it is, it's a long con. We've gone back to them a couple times since the story ran on Friday and said, hey, tell us more. You know, how did you get to this $650 a night number for cost? Give us more evidence, and we've heard nothing. So if it's a con, they're still working on it.
Well, given that the national debt is now in excess of $23 trillion, I think that, you know, $650 a night, what are we complaining about here? The other thing, then, let's move on to emoluments. Another emoluments case seems to have gone away. This was about individual members of Congress suing the president. The courts have thrown that out now?
They did. This was thrown out by a panel of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and this was not a panel of Trump appointees or, you know, these were a pretty ideologically mixed bunch of judges. This was just not a great idea for a lawsuit. So, as you said, this was a sort of a collection of Democratic members of Congress suing on their own, and that courts are just never going to let that work. Or the Congress has to speak as Congress, not as a bunch of members.
Yeah. The other thing is that the president has started to clean house of those who testified against him. I was a little surprised that not only did he fire Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, who we all know, but also his twin brother. What did the brother do?
They haven't actually said. They haven't explained why the brother was fired. But these are people. So it's important to know these both the Vindmans are in the Army, and they haven't been fired from the Army. They just had special assignments in the White House working for the National Security Council. So they just went back to the Army. So they've been fired, but not they haven't lost their jobs.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that was just out of the White House, but they maintain their jobs, their pensions, everything else.
Yeah, I think they just work in some other part of the Army now.
Okay. That's good. I noticed in a column, and I think it was in the Washington, well, I don't know, it might have been the Post, that there are some Democrats saying they might have to impeach him again.
I mean, certainly the Constitution allows that, and I don't think the Democrats want to go out and say, you know, we'll never impeach him again. He already has gotten so much carte blanche from the Republicans, who, other than Mitt Romney, said, well, you know, this was bad, but I don't want to exercise my power to stop it. So I don't see Trump being impeached again, at least not before the end of his first term, but it's certainly possible.
Okay, well, that's good. One was enough for me. David Farenthold, live from the Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And now joining us live is resident historian Felix Bunnell. And I understand, I just saw your tweet, Felix. You're headed down to the archives this morning?
Yes, I am. There are officials from Washington, D.C. with the National Archives and Record Administration who are in town this week quietly meeting with, we're not sure who they're meeting with exactly, but there's a rumor that at 10 o'clock this morning, representatives from local Native American tribes have been invited to hear from the National Archives about their plans to shut that building down.
Right. This is the story that we've been following. Actually, the story that you broke, that the National Archives building on Sandpoint Way, relied upon by UW researchers and tribal organizations and historians like you, will be shut down. And the records, which record the history of the Northwest, moved to California, of all places. Now, my understanding is, and I'm basing this on your tweet, so it comes from an authoritative source, is that this meeting was not supposed to be open to members of the press, which you are. So is this like civil disobedience of some kind that you are contemplating this morning?
No. I asked permission if I could observe the meeting, and I was told that it's only by invitation only. The press is not welcome. But I am planning on being outside the building to talk to tribal representatives on their way in to find out how they feel about the process so far, and then to talk to them on the way out to find out, you know, what they learned from the National Archives people and what the plan is moving forward, because this affects Native American tribes probably more than any other group who uses that archives.
I see. So you will not try to crash the meeting, but you will be on public land where you are entitled to be questioning people on the way in and on the way out.
Yeah. You know me, Dave. I'm not rude or boorish.
No,
usually.
I know that. But I know what happens to you when you think there's a missing gargoyle somewhere, and I wouldn't put it past you to try to sneak into the meeting somehow.
No, that would reflect poorly on Cairo, reflect poorly on me. Okay. I have utmost respect for our public officials, but I just want to see more transparency, and I want to know what's going on. I want people to know what's going on with the building and the archive materials that belongs to all of us.
Okay. Are you not carrying a sign of any kind?
I was contemplating having my sign that, you know, keep your government hands off my National Archives, but I think I was talked out of it by cooler heads.
You're not wearing a T-shirt with a ribald statement of some kind?
No, it's all about just truth and transparency in the American way.
Okay. All right. Sounds like a T-shirt. Sounds like a T-shirt to me. All right, Felix, we'll continue to fight for what's right.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Just don't say anything starting with hey, hey, ho, ho, because I've heard enough of that.
I'll ask people, hey, do you know Dave Ross? I work with Dave Ross. Do you know him? I'll try that as my opening line.
Oh, that'll get, that's your golden ticket in. All right, Felix, thank you. Stay out of jail. That's all I'm asking you. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.